What aspects of the Bush administration's attack on Iraq do you see as critical that aren't being discussed currently in the media?
Wow. Boy, that's volume two of my book, Mike. There's a whole lot that's not being discussed. First of all, who's getting killed? Okay, and people talk about Iraqis. Let's get a little more specific than that. In Gulf War One, we saw all those cool pictures from CNN called target footage, in which you're looking through the camera eye of a smart bomb that's going tick, 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 boom, and you see this, you know, ammo dump explode, and you say, well, that's cool, we got those guys. That's not too gory. What you didn't see pictures of was the high-level bombing of refugees trying to escape out of Basra, and Iraqis and others trying to escape out of Kuwait as bombs are falling, and miles of bombed out Volkswagens, you know, just people leaving with their kids and cats and grandmas in their cars and just were incinerated because they were on the road at the wrong time. Miles and miles of blood and wreckage. And I always thought that Saddam Hussein was going to give George Bush a medal for that, because what we did was the people we killed, we figured maybe, Schwarzkopf estimates maybe 100,000, were the Shiites who oppose Saddam Hussein. And we basically destroyed the Shiite opposition. We just bombed them into smithereens. So when we talk about innocent Iraqis, and most Americans are snickering like, what's an innocent Iraqi? You're talking about the people who are going to die here, mostly people who are trying to get rid of Saddam Hussein. And we don't talk about that little unpleasantness. And believe me, there's a lot of Iraqis, I don't know of any, I've never met an Iraqi that thinks that Saddam is a nice guy and shouldn't go. But we used to have, when our president talks about regime change, but I would remind him that we, in America, we had a system of regime change, we call it elections. And interestingly, only Iran, to our shame, has called for elections in Iraq. You notice that we've talked about the general term, we're bringing democracy, but we haven't actually said we'll allow elections.
Talk about members of the current administration, how they actually helped Saddam into power.
First of all, I mean, the one argument for going in is that since the Bush family hired Saddam, I guess they have the right to fire him. You know, one thing you'll find in my book is that I obtained documents showing that the Saudi Arabians gave $7 billion to Saddam Hussein and his Ba'athist killer government to build an atomic bomb. And that was during the Reagan and Bush administration. Now, that's when we've had Condoleezza Rice say, it's absolutely terrible that we've allowed this butcher to stay in Baghdad for 12 years. Well, of course, hey, wait a minute. He's been in power 24 years. But she was saying the first 12 years, it was good to have that butcher in Baghdad because he was our butcher. It's where we got our chops. And we allowed the Saudis to let him buy nuclear components. He never finished the bomb, but we allowed him to buy these components because he was going to vaporize Iranians. And, you know, this is before the Axis of Evil, when the Iranians were the unicycle of evil. So he was on our payroll for that. We now know, and in a rare good story from the New York Times, they simply noted that when we're looking for anthrax, which Saddam bought, by the way, in Virginia with the U.S. government's export license approval. So, you know, what we're doing is we're going to grab the guy that we created, the monster we created in our Frankenstein factory. And by the way, that's not different than Osama bin Laden. Who do you think created Osama bin Laden and trained him in terrorism? Let's not kid ourselves. Remember, the Bush family had been very close to the bin Laden family, still is very close to the bin Laden family, except for Osama. And the U.S. government and Bush was thrilled that their buddies, the bin Laden family, would donate one of their eldest sons, Osama, to take on the jihad against the nasty old Soviet Empire. And you'll see in my book, for BBC television, we found a foreign officer of the U.S. State Department stationed in Riyadh, who is required to hand out visas to people he knew were terrorists to come into the United States. We gave these guys visas. You know, when we talk about them taking flying lessons, yeah, because they got visas. And we knew who they were, too, by the way, because they were brought in originally to fight the evil Soviets. And he said he complained about this, but he thought it was that we were giving these people visas because of bribery, and then realized, and he was told, no, you must give these characters visas. This is what the intelligence community calls blowback. In other words, you create the Frankenstein, then he gets off the table and goes after his maker. We had no problem with Osama and his fanatics when they were killing Russian troops. They would capture Russians and skin them alive if they didn't convert to Islam. These were never nice guys, okay? And then while we didn't support Osama and his crew when they were fighting in Bosnia, the Clinton administration did, I want you to remember, give a kind of wink and nod to allow them to operate there. But in the case of Saddam, it's the same story. Who created his oil fields? Halliburton Corporation, Dick Cheney. You have to understand that he was our guy. You know, we have all those, I just recently saw one of those great grinning pictures of Donald Rumsfeld shaking hands with the butcher of Baghdad, you know, and who knows what Rumsfeld got as a, you know, as a going away gift, maybe some dissidents, you know, fingernails or toes or something in a box.
Another thing you brought out in your latest edition of your book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, is the Bush administration had held back on an investigation into the bin Ladens. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. What happened was that the FBI was, you know, hoping to investigate two American members of the bin Laden family. Now, I'm careful here. Not everyone named bin Laden's a terrorist or has anything to do with terrorism. But there were two guys who were involved in an organization called WAMY. And that organization, by the way, in case you're wondering whether the FBI was just going after its usual hunt of Girl Scouts and nuns, one of their members of the staff of this organization actually carried the last audio tape from Osama to Al Jazeera TV for broadcast. So, you know, these guys have some connections worth investigating. Yet, up until September 13th, in other words, 2 days after the attack, the FBI agents were not allowed to investigate these guys. Now, the ostensible reason is because a political decision had been made that we're not supposed to bother our friends the Saudis. Don't upset them. Don't upset the bin Laden family, which is powerful in Saudi Arabia. Don't upset the royal family. Don't upset Adnan Khashoggi, the arms dealer. But the question is that policy of not upsetting our Saudi friends and not investigating them, is that poisoned or contaminated by the fact that some of these people, the bin Laden family, Adnan Khashoggi, and a guy named Sheikh Abdullah Baksh, another Saudi billionaire, whether the Bush family's business dealings with them led to this prejudice and decision by the national security agencies not to investigate these Saudis.
And it seems like the Bush family has a lot of ties to the Saudis.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, I mean, ties is one way to put it. It's not like a three-legged sack race at the company picnic. It's cash, right? Sheikh Abdullah Baksh, for example, I just mentioned him. George W. made millions in the oil business. And yet, he drilled nothing but dry holes. He punched a lot of holes in Texas, which came up with nothing. But what he was able to successfully do was drill into the pockets of several Saudi sheikhs, one being Abdullah Baksh. When George's third oil company was going down for the third time, this is Harkin Oil, Sheikh Abdullah Baksh stepped in and had the company refinanced. In addition, the Saudis, or I should say Gulf interests, because not just the Saudis in that case, obtained an offshore oil drilling contract for Bush's company off the coast of Bahrain. And now, that was very unusual because Bush's oil companies, you know, Texas sagebrush drillers, you know, like they like something under their feet. They don't float on water. And yet, Amoco Oil was pushed aside for these inexperienced, small-time Texas drillers. Does that have anything to do, by the way, with the fact that W's father was the president of the free world? Then I should say that George Bush, after he left the White House, went to work for a Canadian gold mining company that was founded by the arms dealer Adnan Khashoggi. We now know that Adnan was also making investments most recently in Richard Pearl, the foreign policy advisor to the administration. So that's just some of the connections that go back. And, of course, the bin Laden family supported the Carlyle Corporation, in which both George W. and Daddy Bush worked. Daddy Bush still works there as representative to Saudi Arabia and Asia for that corporation. W., by the way, got a job at Carlyle. I suppose it had nothing to do, and remember, Bush is very much against affirmative action. He said people should only get their positions by merit. I'm sure it was his incredible business acumen that got him a gig paying about $50,000 to sit on the board of a subsidiary of Carlyle Group called Cater Air. But despite George's incredible, our current president's incredible business skills, the company swiftly went under.
Talk about the war on terror and the people and or companies that are cashing in on that.
Yeah, well, you know, the war on terror is terrifying for two reasons. One, we're getting killed and they're not doing anything about it. And two, they're distracting us with Iraq, which is becoming the weapon of mass distraction. Where is Osama? The answer is attack Saddam. But the other thing we're not noticing is who's ringing the cash registers, who's making the money. And Forbes magazine, though, did identify winners. Says we don't know who lost the war on terror, but we won. The company is ChoicePoint. ChoicePoint won. ChoicePoint is a company with 20 billion data records on all Americans, and they're getting these contracts for the kind of total information awareness operation, our new internal KGB that has been formed to spy on Americans. Keep in mind, by the way, that there were 19 hijackers. Not one was an American citizen, and yet somehow we are now the enemy, right? But who is ChoicePoint? By the way, among the other things that they're doing is that they own a company called Bode Technologies, B-O-D-E. Bode is the biggest supplier of DNA to the FBI, DNA information to the FBI. And just this week, the FBI announced another $1 billion to build up its DNA database. This is, by the way, done, they say, not only to fight the war on terror, but in case your kids ever get snatched by fundamentalist Mormons and things like that, you can, you know, we can use their DNA samples to go find them so you don't have to put their face on a milk carton. And that's all to make you feel very good about Big Brother putting his big arm around you to protect you. But anyway, that all that information goes into the FBI CODIS files to the great profit of ChoicePoint. ChoicePoint is the company that basically selected the president of the United States. They're the company that 5 months before the election came up with a list of tens of thousands of voters in Florida that were supposedly felons, and they were removed from the voter rolls. It turns out that almost every person on that list, almost every person on that list of 94,000, as it now turns out, almost every person was innocent of any crime except being black. 54% of the people were black. If that whole list had been allowed to vote, Al Gore would have won by tens of thousands, according to BBC's experts. It's a story I reported in London, and it's in the book. But now we're looking at the payday for the company that did this nice little deed for the Republican Party, ChoicePoint. So they're getting these big contracts, airport profiling, immigration intake information, DNA databases, data mining on your personal finances, et cetera. I mean, so they're cashing in big time. And that's just one. There's, you know, John Poindexter is the head of the Total Information Awareness Operation, who's the big contractor to supply the software to look through ChoicePoint's databases is a company called Syntec. And Syntec, who founded Syntec? John Poindexter, in other words, the guy that's now head of Total Information Awareness. So, you know, it's a nice little daisy chain in which the donors and the fixers and the friends of Bush and the people in the administration are making quite a bit of money. In fact, the tie-up between Pearl and Khashoggi is to sell anti-terrorism equipment. Marvin Bush has gotten into the act. He invests in a company which is a principal owner of the computer firms which supply what's called Patriot-compliant software. The USA Patriot Act requires every bank to have databases which match those of ChoicePoint. It's all becoming a very nice little link-up. So they all have to be able to link up with ChoicePoint so that the FBI can go through your private records and the banks can go through your records. And that software, that kind of linking software, which is extremely expensive and complex, is ultimately enriching Marvin Bush. I'm glad that at least the Bush family is doing well. Maybe then, after W. leaves the White House, unlike his daddy, he won't have to go for example, work for gold mining companies in Canada. The other thing is, you know, who won Gulf War One? It's also brought up in the new edition of my book. Did we ever get that democracy we were promised in Kuwait? I don't think so. I'm waiting for the election returns from Kuwait. They haven't arrived yet, you know. But I do know that Daddy Bush left the White House and wrote a letter to the Kuwaitis asking for an oil concession for Chevron Oil Corporation. Chevron Oil Corporation then put a pile of money, about over $500,000, into his son's campaign war chest for president through the soft money donation to the Republican Party. So these are the money links. So if you know who cashed in, who's cashing now in the war on terror, who cashed in on the last Gulf War, and by the way, there was one guy who did complain about the Bush family cashing in on the Gulf War, Norman Schwarzkopf, and you haven't heard a lot from him lately.
One of the other things George Bush Sr. signed when he left office was pardons for people like John Poindexter, I believe.
Well, actually, Poindexter, that's the other thing, is that who's the head of the War on Terror operation is John Poindexter, and as the Washington Post says in its coy way, he was a prominent figure in the Iran-Contra scandal. He wasn't a prominent figure. He was convicted of 5 counts of felony perjury, and what he was convicted of in particular was supporting organizations trying to overthrow the elected government of Nicaragua and, you know, dealing with terrorists and rogue states to bring in arms into Nicaragua. It is what, under the Patriot Act, is called terrorism. So in other words, the guy in charge of our anti-terrorism fight is one of the few people in America who's ever been convicted of terrorism. And, you know, you gotta laugh, because otherwise, you know, you just cry. You gotta laugh. And it's true that his convictions were overturned on a technicality. People should understand what that technicality was. He confessed, but he did so at the U.S. Senate, which gave him immunity from prosecution. So the, you know, the judges ruled that his confession, full confession about basically being a terrorist, that the convictions against him could not stand, and so he has a nice little job hiring his own company to run the war on terror.
You were one of the key people to bring out information about the IMF and World Bank and the way it underhandedly attacks other countries.
Well, I mean, secretly, the fourth chapter of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy is called Sell the Lexus, Burn the Olive Tree, in response to Thomas Friedman. His book, which was like this kind of cliche-ridden deep kiss to globalization. What I have is the facts. In fact, part of the chapter is you'll see in Harper's Magazine this month. What I have is documents from inside the World Bank and from inside the World Trade Organization and from inside the IMF. Marked secret, confidential, read this and eat this, you know, don't look at this and then burn it, and et cetera. And it's all the secret plans for nations including Argentina, Bolivia, Ecuador, Tanzania, Bosnia. I have several of these plans, which basically what they are is a listing of conditions that a nation must meet in order to have access to capital financing on the world markets. And no nation can survive without that. So these nations are forced to sign off on what they call conditionalities, and typically 114 per nation. And some of them are pretty darn brutal. First of all, there's a sale of assets, which are always required. I mean, there is no exception to that. They have to sell off their water systems, their electricity systems, their gas systems, their telephone systems, etc., supposedly to make these systems more rational. But in fact, one of the first privatizations, the wave of privatizations, came out of Argentina, which ended up selling its, for example, its Buenos Aires water system to a company called Enron. Well, needless to say, Enron took off with the loot, the water's contaminated, and the prices are up. You know, this is what's contained in these documents, plus things like raising the price of food, eliminating labor union rights, they call that creating a flexible workforce, cutting unemployment benefits. That was one of my favorites in the Argentine, secret Argentine document, under the heading Helping the poor and unemployed was a requirement to cut unemployment compensation by 20%. The creepier things in it is where they talk about, in the Ecuador document, talks about, we know if we do this, impose these terrible things, that there will be riots. You know, so like the riots planned in. I talked to Joe Stiglitz, who is chief economist of the World Bank, a recently won a Nobel Prize. He said, yeah, I was there. We called that the IMF ride. They really were written into the plans. We knew that there would be explosions, and then once there's an explosion in a nation, then they have to sign off on all the rest of the conditions. The one thing about the best democracy money can buy, that especially in the New American Edition, is that you will see photocopies of a lot of these documents. You can also go to my website, www.gregpalast.com. That's G-R-E-G-P-A-L-A-S-T. And I have some documents up. There'll be more and more added. In fact, you can see my BBC reports that you're not allowed to look at on American TV. Just go to the left side of the homepage and click on BBC video, and you will see the reports about Bush and Bin Laden, the quashing of the FBI investigations, the theft of the election in Florida. You'll see my stories about Venezuela, you know, another topic not covered in the U.S. press except through complete nonsense and disinformation. So, you know, like I say, in the new book, you'll get a lot about the how the World Bank really operates, not the fantasy of Thomas Friedman, but what are in the real documents.
Talk a little bit more about Venezuela, because right now most Americans are seeing prices at the gas pumps way up, and one of the dogs that we kick about that is Venezuela.
That's right. Well, in fact, this is another brilliant idea of George Bush, was to overthrow the elected government of Venezuela. Our fingerprints were all over a goofed-up, failed coup d'etat last April, in which Otto Reich, who was the undersecretary, who was undersecretary for Latin American Affairs under Colin Powell, met with a bunch of right-wing fruitcakes and media moguls, billionaires, and madmen who decided, and after they met with him, they went out and kidnapped the president of Venezuela at gunpoint. Our newspapers then announced that Chavez had resigned. In other words, giving legitimacy to this crack brain coup d'etat. In fact, he had never resigned. In fact, I was working at the Guardian in London, and I stayed up all night calling to Venezuela until I got to people who actually spoke to Chavez. He'd been given a cell phone by one of the guards who was sympathetic to him, and he called out. He said, I haven't resigned from nothing, so I got that word out. But he didn't see that in the U.S. papers. But the U.S. engineered that knucklehead coup. Chavez was brought back safe, but our president was not satisfied. Venezuela is kind of our extra gas tank. They've got the biggest pool of oil outside the United States in our hemisphere. And it was Venezuela that broke the back of the 1973 Arab oil embargo by ramping up production. We count on Venezuela to destroy OPEC when we need to. Sometimes we like OPEC, sometimes we need to pull its chain. That's Venezuela's job. Hugo Chavez became president not only of Venezuela, he became president of OPEC, and he restored the organization to power, to authority, because he was trying to get money to rebuild the poor areas of Caracas. It's a brutally poor place, and yet it's sitting on top of a giant pool of oil. And most of the people of Venezuela never got any benefit out of that oil. It all went to the white people. The nation's split just like South Africa, about 20% white, 80% Indian. And he's an Indian, first Indian president ever elected in Venezuela, and he just said, well, it's time for us Indians to have a little piece of this oil action. And the U.S. administration, Bill Clinton liked Chavez a lot. They got along very well. But suddenly, since Bush came in, our press has played George W. Bush's line that Chavez is a would-be dictator and a madman and a fruitcake and a communist. And they've played this berserker Bush line, complete disinformation, without questioning it. And yet this was the guy that we thought was a really nice guy and a strong ally of ours, you know, just a couple years ago when Bill Clinton was president. We got along very well. So now we've been basically at war with Venezuela, and it blew up in our face because we ended up engineering a general strike against the guy. It wasn't a strike. It was a lockout by the white managers of the oil company who then sabotaged the oil equipment. And when that failed to overthrow Chavez, we now have still Chavez in power. He was elected by the people overwhelmingly. But we also have a sabotaged oil infrastructure there, and that means that the entire price of oil worldwide is up. So it's not from Iraq that the price of oil is up. It's from Venezuela, and that had to do with the goofy machinations of our administration. Colin Powell, by the way, fired the nutcase in the administration that was monkeying around Venezuela, Otto Reich. And then, lo and behold, Powell fires him. Bush rehires him and puts him back in the White House, where he sits today closer to the president than Colin Powell.
When we talked to you a year ago, you had just moved your family, I believe, to California. Have you been getting picked up on any U.S. media since then? Have things improved?
Well, actually, I hadn't moved yet. I just moved my family back to the USA from London, and they're in New York now, and my kids are enrolled in school so that they can get rid of those goofy English accents. And, you know, it's very, very difficult. I almost got on. I mean, I was supposed to be a regular on the Phil Donahue show, but, you know, they've thrown his bullet-riddled career out the window at MSNBC because there was an internal memo saying that he has too many guys like me on the air that were, to quote the memo, skeptical of the Bush administration. I guess I am skeptical. But, you know, I thought that that's a job of reporters to be skeptical. But anyway, skepticism and asking tough questions is not permitted now, apparently, in the USA. Dan Rather was on my show. Another reporter was talking to him, but he said, I can't ask tough questions on US TV. I'd be lynched. I'd be called unpatriotic. So if Dan Rather can't ask tough questions, then, you know, I don't think they're going to let me on to do it. And there's a couple cracks in the electronic Berlin Wall. I've been asked to be on Charlie Rose and Bill Moyers. But that's, you know, the usual, you know, what they call the liberal press is in fact, just this tiny little island in a sea of corporate propaganda which surrounds it. So is there a place for me on that tiny island? There might be. But for the most part, if you want to get these reports that are available every day on BBC television that I do or in the Guardian papers that I can write in, the only way you're going to get them is you're going to have to read a book, which is kind of nice because, you know, I thought it was kind of going out of style there for a while. But if you read The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, you get the whole all these Samizdat reports, which you're not otherwise allowed to have. In fact, I made a decision this week that I'm going to concentrate mainly on writing books because if I try to do television, I have to do it overseas. And if I want to write for a newspaper, I'm put in the marginalized papers of America. I mean, I love writing for Nation, Mother Jones, Progressive, etc., but how am I going to talk to America that way? So I'm going to try to see if I can convince Americans to read books. Good luck, huh?
Well, you are currently on a book tour across the U.S.
Yeah, I'm on a book tour. Actually, I'm grateful I'm on the New York Times bestseller list with The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. And, you know, it's one nice thing is the paperback edition is a whole new edition just for the United States. It cannot be sold outside the United States, by the way. I won't allow it to be sold outside the United States. It's twice as many pages as the old British hardbound. Because believe it or not, the rest of the world has official censorship, which we don't have. We have a First Amendment. This is why, you know, this is why we sing God Bless America. We really have something unique here. You know, we just have to be careful that we have this extraordinary thing called the Bill of Rights. Of course, we got a guy who's seized the White House, who has a very big eraser, who is convinced that the Bill of Rights is not written in indelible ink. So that's what's at stake right now. That's why I'm glad I'm back here right now. I think we got a heck of a fight on our hands, and I'd hate to be offshore when that's happening.
And you're going to be coming to Seattle on April 8th.
That's right. I'll be at Seattle on April 8th. And I can't wait to see you then. We'll talk about these things. We'll talk about who's cashing in. We'll do a little review of at that time to see who's the latest company to cash in. Will it be ChoicePoint? Will it be Halliburton? Will it be ExxonMobil? We'll do a little list, okay? And we'll have some fun. And, you know, the other thing is, like I say, it's a way for us also to get together and organize. Each one of my talks in cities, normally book authors just go bookstore to bookstore. I've been doing fundraisers for alternative media and having community meetings, which become then basically a way for us to get together, think, organize, and act.
Very good. Well, we'll be checking out your website, and I know that a lot of people here in Seattle are looking forward to seeing you in person on April the 8th. So I want to thank you for talking with us today.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity before they shut down your station.